Paul Rand and his work have been much discussed and extolled. Thoughts on Design has been called a manifesto and a Bible on modern graphic design. When Steve Jobs hired him to design the logo for Next Computer in 1986, he called him the greatest living graphic designer. In a speech honoring Rand, at which he was present, George Lois of Esquire magazine said, "Every art director and graphic designer in the world should kiss his ass." In the introduction to Thoughts on Design, Paul Rand acknowledges that, quote, "many writers and philosophers have helped to crystallize my thinking." He calls out John Dewey and Roger Fry in particular. He also refers to some characters from ancient Greece and Rome, including Polykleitos, Vitruvius, and Plato. Who were these Rand influencers, and what insights might they offer today's designer? As I reread this exposition of Rand's principles, I wasn't finding a lot of relevance to my work today, but then I'm not an art director or graphic designer. So I decided to go a level deeper, reading source material from Dewey and Fry and revisiting ancient works, to see what I could take away from these influencers. In doing so, I explore questions like, how far back does the idea of form follows function go? What do we find so fascinating and instructive about the proportions of the human body? And how does Plato's views on the early education of philosophers relate to the role of humor in design? I hope you'll join me on this alternative approach to learning from this towering figure of design history. So we're going to start with the first section of the book, probably my favorite, titled The Beautiful and the Useful. It's kind of a poetic expression of the age-old interplay between form and function and the tension between them. Before I jump into the passage, I did just want to define a few terms that show up in here. First is semiotics. That's the study of signs and symbols and their use or interpretation. Next is exigencies. So this is an urgent need or demand, although I sort of thought of this as more like constraints in the context that we'll hear it in. Next, the word symmetria. So similar to symmetry, but a little different. It's an old Greek word that has to do with proportions and how different parts of something relate to each other, specifically in the context of the human body, ideal mathematical proportions, and how you approach representing that, say, in sculpture. And then the last one I have here is gestalt. This is the perception of the whole as more than the sum of parts. With those definitions in mind, we'll read the first few stanzas, as it were, of The Beautiful and the Useful. Graphic design, which fulfills aesthetic needs, complies with the laws of form and the exigencies of two-dimensional space, which speaks in semiotics, sans serifs, and geometrics, which abstracts, transforms, translates, rotates, dilates, repeats, mirrors, groups and regroups, is not good design if it is irrelevant. Graphic design, which evokes the symmetria of Vitruvius, the dynamic symmetry of Hambidge, the asymmetry of Mondrian, which is a good gestalt, which is generated by intuition or by computer, by invention or by a system of coordinates, is not good design if it does not cooperate as an instrument in the service of communication. So those are the first two paragraphs of this section, and we just want to dig into these a little bit. I think it's interesting to note that, so he's kind of talking about sort of defining good design, which you know, a number of people have done in different ways. In this way, he does it in these sort of two very dense statements. When it comes down to it, he's really saying what it is not, at least from a couple perspectives. So if we leave out sort of all that stuff in the middle, he's really saying two things here. Graphic design is not good design if it is irrelevant. And graphic design is not good design if it does not cooperate as an instrument in the service of communication. In saying that good design is not good design if it's irrelevant, that kind of reminds me of the concept of pragmatics that Vignelli talks about, where you know, you can have something that's very visually impressive, but if it doesn't sort of have the intended outcome, it was all a waste of time. So if it's irrelevant, if it doesn't, you know, do anything, then we can't call that good design. And then next, if it does not cooperate as an instrument in the service of communication. I guess this is kind of a combination of semantics and syntax in terms of the way that you're sort of the language that you're using. Communication is a combination of kind of meaning and medium. I think it's kind of an interesting approach. So the other piece of these two paragraphs here is he is defining graphic design in positive terms, meaning not saying what it is not. So he's saying graphic design, which is this, which is that. So there's some interesting stuff there. Some of it is kind of conceptual. Some of it is pretty technical. He uses the word dilates. Not really sure what I'm supposed to do with that, but it's kind of an interesting way to kick things off. I'm going to read the next couple paragraphs. These are a little bit more straightforward prose, and I think a little more helpful in providing some perspective and inspiration. So right after those two pieces that we just read, he continues, "Visual communications of any kind, whether persuasive or informative, from billboards to birth announcements, should be seen as the embodiment of form and function, the integration of the beautiful and the useful. In an advertisement, copy, art, and typography are seen as a living entity, each element integrally related, in harmony with the whole, and essential to the execution of the idea. Like a juggler, the designer demonstrates his skills by manipulating these ingredients in a given space, whether this space takes the form of advertisements, periodicals, books, printed forms, packages, industrial products, signs, or TV billboards. The criteria are the same." I'm just pausing here. So we get a little bit more of kind of his view and his philosophy in terms of how he's thinking about the practice of design and how this connects to the integration of form and function. It's interesting in this last sentence here, whether this space takes the form of these various types of artifact, the criteria are the same. He doesn't define the criteria per se, but just the idea that all types of design have some sort of relation to each other and are in some way connected. This is something that we heard both from Henry Dreyfuss and from Vignelli, that there's a sort of unified practice of design. Continuing into the next paragraph here, "that the separation of form and function, of concept and execution, is not likely to produce objects of aesthetic value has been repeatedly demonstrated. Similarly, it has been shown that the system which regards ethics as irrelevant, which separates the artist from his product, which fragments the work of the individual, which creates by committee, and which makes mincemeat of the creative process, will, in the long run, diminish not only the product, but the maker as well." So a couple of interesting things here. One, we see that he's clearly making a strong statement that the creative process needs to be integrated. You can't separate the idea from the execution. You can't separate sort of the designer from the craft. You also can't, well, you're not going to end up with good results in the long run. If you're trying to design by committee, we can't treat it like an assembly line where there's this kind of division of labor. It needs to be an integrated process. So this passage or this section continues a little bit. I'm going to skip over that stuff for now. We'll talk some more about some of those things later. So I just wanted to continue a little bit on this theme of form and function. So there is the phrase that many of us are probably familiar with, form follows function. And this is the idea that you start with kind of what you need something to do, what are the functional aspects of what is needed for something to be useful. And then the form kind of evolves from that or comes out of that. And ideally, they should be connected to each other in some way. There should be a harmony there between form and function. As I was going through this section, but I was sort of curious about where that came from. Apparently, it was originally coined by an architect named Louis Sullivan. And this goes back pretty far. This is in 1896. He used this phrase in an article titled "The Tall Office Building Artistically Considered." And so the full quote here, "Whether it be the sweeping eagle in his flight or the open apple blossom, the toiling workhorse, the blithe swan, the branching oak, the winding stream at its base, the drifting clouds, over all the coursing sun, form ever follows function, and this is the law." So the interesting thing to note here is that although he is attributed with the first usage of this phrase in modern times, he actually attributes the core idea to the Roman architect, engineer, and author Marcus Vitruvius Pollio, who first asserted in his book De Architectura that a structure must exhibit three qualities of firmitas, utilitas, venustas. That is, it must be solid, useful, and beautiful. So that sounds familiar. So there's definitely a connection there. And you may have recognized the name there, Vitruvius. So that actually came up in the passage that we read earlier. Let me just go back to that. The second paragraph, graphic design, which evokes the symmetria of Vitruvius. So that's who Rand is talking about there. If we just go back and look at this piece of history for a little bit. So again, Roman architect, first century BC. So we're talking this born somewhere between 80 and 70 BC and died in 15 BC. So he put together this multi-volume work, De Architectura. And there's sort of different translations that you see of these words, but utility and beauty are pretty common. Sometimes we see strength. Sometimes we see endurance, solidity. These were kind of these core principles that he laid out in the construction of buildings. And even though he's attributed with this work, he actually, you know, references some even earlier influences that we probably don't really have any record of. Even his work was kind of lost for many centuries and kind of rediscovered in the Renaissance period. So we'll return to the ancient times more later. But for now, I did want to mention one other part, quoting John Dewey here in Art as Experience. I'll just read a little bit of it. John Dewey, commenting on the relationship between fine art and useful or technological art, says that many, perhaps most, of the articles and utensils made at present for use are not genuinely aesthetic, happens, unfortunately, to be true. I'm not sure the exact time he's writing this, but it's definitely early 20th century. I thought that was kind of funny to hear his comment there, because around the same time, in episode one, when we were talking about Henry Dreyfuss and his early career, there was that anecdote where he was given the opportunity to walk around Macy's and, you know, ask anything you see you don't like, just redesign it. And he basically said he didn't like any of it, that it was all kind of garbage. He did not end up taking that job. But so at this point in time, there was not really a good combination of beauty and utility. And maybe that's what Rand was getting at here, is that there's this long history and this ancient knowledge of how these two aspects work together, but we're not always thinking about it, and we're not always making the best use of it. Today, there are some variations of how we talk about this, especially in digital design. We tend to hear the phrase useful, usable, and delightful. And so I think this is really just an extension of form and function, but there are a couple added dimensions here. One, the idea of usability. So as objects have become more complex, especially with digital products, things that are more analog and kind of simpler tools, you know, the shape of a handle kind of indicates how you interact with it and what it's for and what you can do with it. When you're talking about, you know, whether it's like a VCR with a little screen and some vague buttons, or just a touch screen, it's not as obvious. There's a lot more going on under the hood. And so usability and how you help someone understand how to interact with that thing becomes more important. And number two, this aspect of delight. So it's pretty close to the beauty part, the form part, but it does, I would say, go beyond just visual aesthetics and really gets us to think about the whole experience that someone is having with a product or service. How does it make them feel? What are those emotions that arise from interaction with the product, not just observation? So for this next section, I want to talk about human proportion and our apparent fascination with this over the centuries. Now, this is not something Rand talks about explicitly in Thoughts on Design, but as part of my digging deeper into the various influences that he mentions, I started to kind of see this interesting theme come up at different points. So returning to the ancient world here for a bit, this is actually in the preface to the third edition, the year 1970. But in the second paragraph here, he says, "When this book was first written, it was the writer's intention," meaning his, "to demonstrate the validity of those principles which, by and large, have guided artists, designers, since the time of Polycletus," not sure if I'm saying that right. "The author," Rand, "believes that it is only in the application of those timeless principles that one can even begin to achieve a semblance of quality in one's work or understand the transient nature of the fashionable. It is the continuing relevance of these principles that he wishes to emphasize, especially to those students and designers who have grown up in a world of pop and minimal art." Okay, so he's kind of making the case there to, you know, study design history, which is what we're doing here. But so he mentions this person, Polycletus. It's spelled a couple different ways. P OlyCletus in the book, but it's slightly different on Wikipedia. So now we're going back earlier here. We're going back to the 5th century BCE in Greece. This guy is considered one of the most important sculptors of classical antiquity. He's known for his lost treatise, The Canon of Polykleitos, also known as A Canon of Body Proportions, which set out his mathematical basis of an idealized male body shape. So this goes back to that word symmetria that we defined in the first part and we heard in the first paragraph. So none of his original sculptures are known to survive, but many marble works, mostly Roman, are believed to be later copies. The art historian Kenneth Clark observed that his general aim was clarity, balance, and completeness. His sole medium of communication was the naked body of an athlete standing poised between movement and repose. So in this canon, he basically lays out this kind of theory for how the different parts of the human body are proportionally related to each other. What's super interesting here is that the core mathematical ratio that he uses here is the length of the diagonal of a square of this side. So mathematically, that's the square root of 2, or a ratio of 1.4142. For those avid listeners who remember from episode 2, that ratio, that came up in our conversation about Vignelli and his passionate views on paper sizes. So the reason that he likes the international standard sizes so much, the A3, A4, A5, etc., is that they have a standard ratio between them, which makes scaling much easier. That ratio is 1 to the square root of 2. Same thing we're talking about here. The way this looks, there's an image on the Wikipedia article, but just to kind of describe it a little bit, where it starts or where we sort of imagine that he started from is if you take the distal phalange, so that's the smallest part, smallest sort of segment of one of your fingers. I think maybe it starts with the smallest finger. But if you take that length and then you compare it to the next segment of the finger, it's using that ratio, and then the next one, and then the next one. Eventually it includes sort of the hand and like part of the wrist, and so on and so forth. And so they kind of look at all these different parts, different areas, and apply this ratio. And so this is what he then used in his sculpture work. And again, we don't have a lot of originals, but we have a lot of copies. We can see how this played out and how he applied this kind of underlying mathematical principle to create aesthetic forms. So there's another interesting connection here. So if we fast forward to the Renaissance time, I didn't know this, but there is an image that probably all of us know. It's probably one of his most famous works, but the work of Leonardo da Vinci, where you see the human, naked human body kind of doing jumping jacks inside of a circle, that work is called the Vitruvian Man. So that is actually inspired by Vitruvius, the Roman architect that we talked about earlier. So in addition to kind of laying out these principles, these core principles of the design of buildings and public spaces, he was also very interested in the proportions of man. So elsewhere in his book, De Architectura, or The Departments of Architecture, Vitruvius writes about the proportions of man. Just so the parts of temples should correspond with each other and with the whole. The navel is naturally placed in the center of the human body and if in a man lying with his face upward and his hands and feet extended from his navel as the center, a circle be described, it will touch his fingers and toes. It is not alone by a circle that the human body is thus circumscribed, as may be seen by placing it within a square. For measuring from the feet to the crown of the head, and then across the arms fully extended, we find the latter measure equal to the former. So that lines at right angles to each other, enclosing the figure, will form a square. It was these writings that inspired Renaissance artists, engineers, architects, including Da Vinci, to visualize their own take on this. And so there were different versions of this, different people tried it, really inspired by this idea from Vitruvius that the human figure is sort of the, well, it says here in Wikipedia, the principal source of proportion. So the drawing itself is often used as an applied symbol of the essential symmetry of the human body and by extension of the universe as a whole. That's a bibliographic reference to the whole universe book. So the larger point here, or the idea, is that with the ancients, and then even centuries later with the Renaissance artists, they were very inspired by this idea of, you know, looking toward nature and looking at ourselves and the form of our own bodies to inspire the creation of other things. They felt that there was this kind of underlying mathematical harmony in the natural world, including us, and that if we used that and relied on that, it would result in things that had sort of a natural beauty and a kind of inherent aesthetic that would just sort of feel right. Last thing I wanted to mention on this topic is this idea of human proportion also came up in episode 1 in our discussion of Henry Dreyfus. If you remember, they did a whole work called Measure of Man. So this idea of anthropometry, the kind of scientific or pseudoscientific study of the measurements and proportions of the human body, this was something, you know, for them, it was kind of a sales tool. It gave this impression that it sort of took some of the guesswork out of the design process. And it was like, okay, well, we know that people can reach this far and their hands fit around these kinds of things and their feet can do this and that. Bringing this kind of ergonomics into what essentially became human-computer interaction, some of those ideas where you're really building these more and more complex machines around people, you really have to understand how that human form fits in with these things and connects. They used a bunch of data originally sourced from the military and work that was done there, and then they sort of augmented that with some of their own measurements. You know, we talk about user-centered design, human-centered design. In this case, going back from, you know, 5th century Greece up through 1st century Rome and into modern times, we literally see the importance of keeping humans at the center of the design process. So next, I did want to talk about some aspects of Thoughts on Design that I did find rather confusing. And this is not so much a critique as it is just me kind of working through my own understanding. Talk it out and see where I end up. I did notice going through this book that there weren't as many quotes and ideas and inspiration that kind of jumped out at me as much, and not as much that really resonated. So I think that's an interesting observation in and of itself. In the preface that we read earlier, he did sort of talk about the intent of the book, of laying out these principles, these timeless principles. So I do want to come back to that later, maybe sort of assess whether he does that. But before we get there, there's a few sections that I wanted to talk about. There's some good stuff in here, and then there's some stuff where I was just like, huh? So first up, the role of humor. Rand makes the point in this section that humor can be used effectively and in a sophisticated way. It's not always something that results in tackiness, although it can be used poorly. This is very appropriate because Rand is pretty well known for his kind of playfulness and use of humor, the way that copy and art would interact, especially in his ad work, and just these sort of visual puns. Like he was very into getting people's attention and amusing them. So that totally makes sense. But then he takes an odd turn with the mention of a Plato quote from the Republic on early education. This jumped out to me because I had read this fairly recently, and I didn't quite get the connection that he was making here. So without getting too deep into the Republic, it's Plato writing Socrates' vision for this essentially utopian society that's run by philosopher kings. They go through a very rigorous selective process that includes eugenics, by the way, breed children to be raised for this role. They give up the trappings of personal accumulation and wealth for the honor and duty of ruling and protecting the state. The actual quote that he brings here in talking about humor is, "Therefore, do not use compulsion, but let early education be rather a sort of amusement." So I just don't see the connection there. I don't think that was really in the context of humor. They kind of lay out this plan for, you know, how you teach and train children. So it starts out with some basic kind of academic education, but not too much. It's really focused on the physical. The goal is to train their character, moral, and aesthetic judgment. It is interesting how the arts kind of tie into all this, because they're going to throw out almost all existing poetry at the time, because they just felt like it just gave too many misimpressions of like the gods and all of these kinds of characteristics and behaviors that they didn't want to see in their leaders. They would avoid certain scales in music that would lead to undesirable feelings. I mean, that even kind of goes back to that ratio again, and the tritone or the devil's interval in music. So there were a few scales that were just like, no, we're not going to do that. Everything's just going to sound sort of happy, happy, joy, joy. If the students were to participate in plays, they would only play suitable characters, you know, people who demonstrated the qualities that they wanted. They talk specifically about poetry and music, and then they just kind of throw in, okay, the graphic arts, that's full of all the same types of qualities, so we're just going to lump them in. And there's a quote here, "It is not only to the poets we must issue orders, all artists and craftsmen." My guess is that Rand, although I'm sure he's familiar with this work, I'm not sure there's a lot here that we want to draw on for inspiration for how to approach design. I do think it's interesting, almost at the end of the book, there is a section where they talk about art and artists. There's this kind of foreshadowing of the idea of user-centered design, in that, like, in order to really make something, you really have to have users test it out. And so that's kind of, you know, interesting to see that there. But yeah, in terms of Plato's approach to education of the youth and how that relates to humor, I don't know. I'm not seeing it. The next thing that I was confused by, there's a section called Imagination and the Image. So from what I gather, his point here is ostensibly to avoid cliche. Don't just do the same thing. Don't do what everyone expects. Treat something that's common in an uncommon way to keep things interesting. Then he brings in this quote from Roger Fry, who was an artist. He was a painter, and he was also an art critic. And he was one of the people that Rand specifically mentioned as being influential for him. So he has this essay called Some Questions in Aesthetics. In this essay, he's dealing with the topic of how content and form relate to each other in a work of art and induce in the observer an aesthetic state of mind. So again, this is my interpretation. I'm not an art history student or practicing art critic. This is just me trying to decipher, critique, speak, and understand what Fry is talking about, and then see if I can understand how it relates back to what Rand is talking about. From what I gather, Fry seems to be making the point that in a given painting, either the content or the form dominates. One or the other kind of takes precedence. You can't really have both. So what do I mean there, or what does he mean? By content, my understanding is I'm using the word content. He uses words like representation or illustration, and he doesn't mean like a drawing in terms of illustration. What he's talking about is like, what is the story? Like, what is happening in the scene? And then form, he uses the term plastic creation. They use the word plastic a lot. I don't know. It sounds weird to our modern ears, but it's basically just shape, form. What he's saying there, again, is that either you're telling a good story or you're just kind of focusing more on the visual and you're kind of sacrificing some of the details of what's happening. And it's really hard to get both completely working together. And so, for example, like in a big complex scene about something like the crucifixion, he gives an example there that it's almost pure illustration, as he calls it, meaning, okay, so it still looks like a painting, but if you were just judge it on its visual merits, he says entirely trivial and inexpressive when judged as a plastic and spatial creation. Whereas there are some other works where there's clearly, you know, very impressive forms that we can see, but they kind of give up something on the content side. I don't know what Rand is trying to accomplish by bringing this into this reference into the discussion. The actual quote that he mentions from Fry here is Roger Fry commenting on the problem of integrating representational and plastic elements. Again, I think what he's talking about there is content and form, states, quote, "This may perhaps give us a hint as to the nature of such combinations of two arts, namely that cooperation is most possible where neither of them are pushed to the fullest possibilities of expression, where in both a certain freedom is left to the imagination, where we are moved rather by suggestion than statement," unquote. Okay, so then Rand continues, "Visual statements such as illustrations, which do not involve aesthetic judgment and which are merely literal descriptions of reality, can be neither intellectually stimulating nor visually distinctive." So I think what he's saying is that if it's too literal and kind of too real, it's just not going to be that interesting. By the same token, the indiscriminate use of typefaces, geometric patterns, and abstract shapes, hand or computer generated, is self-defeating when they function merely as a vehicle for self-expression. So maybe what he's talking about there is kind of like what Vignelli was talking about with these meaningless splashes of color across the page. You know, it's not really purposeful, it's arbitrary. So then he concludes this paragraph talking about the converse. So he's saying the visual statement, on the other hand, which seeks to express the essence of an idea and which is based on function, fantasy, and analytic judgment, is likely to be not only unique, but meaningful and memorable as well. Okay. Let's try this one more time. The visual statement which seeks to express the essence of an idea and which is based on function, fantasy, and analytic judgment is likely to be not only unique, but meaningful and memorable as well. I have no idea what the last sentence means. So he gets into something more concrete here. Let's see if this helps. In practice, when an advertisement is submitted for approval, It is prettied up with mat and cellophane and judged as an isolated fragment. Under such conditions, and in the absence of competition, the purely conventional type of illustration may seem quite effective. However, for an advertisement to hold its own in a competitive race, the designer must steer clear of visual clichés by some unexpected interpretation of the commonplace. He does this partly by simplifying, by abstracting, by symbolizing. If the resulting visual image is in any way ambiguous, it may be supplemented by one which is more clearly recognizable. In the examples which follow, the abstract geometric forms, attention-arresting devices, tend to dominate, while the photographic images play a supporting role. So he has a few examples here, a poster of the No Way Out, like a play or something, book cover design for an H.L. Mencken book, a brochure for Autocar. Yeah, I still don't get it. I understand what he's saying here about if you're submitting a work for approval and you're just looking at it in isolation, you're not looking at it sort of in the context that you might see it in, which would be around other maybe competing products. You could just look at something and say, okay, yeah, that works. That's pretty good. But, you know, when it's out there among the competition, it doesn't stand out. So avoiding cliche. Okay, I get that. I'm not as sure what he's getting at here about the abstract geometric forms dominating while the photographic images play a supporting role. Like, maybe that's kind of what he's drawing the parallel here to what Fry is saying, in that such combinations of two arts, cooperation is most possible when neither of them are pushed the fullest possibilities of expression. So maybe that's it, but it just seemed a little bit weird to me in actually looking at what Fry was talking about there. It seems like a little bit of a tenuous connection. Okay, I'm starting to feel like this stuff might be boring. I think it's interesting. I just have one more. There is a passage here called, a section called The Designer's Problem. And so this feels pretty familiar. I mean, we talk about solving problems in design and, like, are we solving the right problem? I think, you know, to some degree, Rand is associated with this idea of treating the design process and the creative process as a problem-solving approach. So there's probably some credit due there to him looking at things this way. But let's look at how he actually describes it here. So the designer's problem. An erroneous conception of the graphic designer's function is to imagine that in order to produce a good layout, quote-unquote, all he need do is make a pleasing arrangement of miscellaneous elements. What is implied is that this may be accomplished simply by pushing these elements around until something happens. At best, this procedure involves the time-consuming uncertainties of trial and error, and at worst, an indifference to plan, order, or discipline. The designer does not, as a rule, begin with some preconceived idea. Rather, the idea is, or should be, the result of careful study and observation, and the design a product of that idea. In order, therefore, to achieve an effective solution to his problem, the designer must necessarily go through some sort of mental process. Consciously or not, he analyzes, interprets, formulates. He is aware of the scientific and technological developments in his own and kindred fields. He improvises, invents, or discovers new techniques and combinations. He coordinates and integrates his material so that he may restate his problem in terms of ideas, signs, symbols, pictures. He unifies, simplifies, and eliminates superfluities. He symbolizes, abstracts from his material by association and analogy. He intensifies and reinforces his symbol with appropriate accessories to achieve clarity and interest. He draws upon instinct and intuition. He considers the spectator, his feelings, and predilections. There's a little bit more here, but I think we need to get the whole picture here to dive into this. The designer is primarily confronted with three classes of material. A, the given material, product, copy, slogan, logotype, format, media, production process. B, the formal material, space, contrast, proportion, harmony, rhythm, repetition, line, mass, shape, color, weight, volume, value, texture. C, the psychological material, visual perception and optical illusion problems, the spectator's instincts, intuitions, and emotions, as well as the designer's own needs. As the material furnished him is often inadequate, vague, uninteresting, or otherwise unsuitable for visual interpretation, the designer's task is to recreate or restate the problem. This may involve discarding or revising much of the given material. By analysis, breaking down of the complex material into its simplest components, the how, why, when, and where, the designer is able to begin to state the problem. Okay, there's some things that make sense here to me. He starts out by talking about this sort of misconception of the role. You know, people who think their function is to just move things around on the page until you have a good layout, that we should be doing research, result of careful study and observation. There's then some sort of creative process that happens either consciously or subconsciously, maybe sometimes unconsciously. Then you've got this material that you're working with. He talks about the three types, and so you've got the given material. I sort of think of this as like the business objective, maybe. What are you trying to accomplish, or what do we think that we're trying to do or produce here? B, the formal material. This is kind of like the medium that you're working in, kind of some of the technical tools of design. So space, contrast, proportion. And then what he calls the psychological material, visual perception, illusion problems. Talking about the kind of the end user, right? Their instincts, intuitions, emotions. He also talks about the designer's own needs. But then he's saying that often the material provided is unsuitable. Maybe he's just talking about the first form of material, the given material. Because the formal material, I mean, sure, you could say, okay, this is not really the right medium. We're going to work in a different medium. But he's also just talking about actual practical tools of design. And then the psychological material, I guess if you could think about this as the user's needs, maybe that haven't been well defined. So I guess you could think about it as that the designer has an important role to play to ensure that we're not getting too far off track here. We're talking about some solution, and that's great, but is that really solving the problem that we're intending to solve? Or are we solving the right problem? Or is it more like, given some challenge, how do we accomplish this goal, like within the medium and the tools that we're working with? Again, I think the idea of design as a creative problem-solving process is very helpful. And I think that's helpful for collaborating with non-designers, getting them to think about things in that way as well. But yeah, just the way that he brings this idea, just not really like hitting home for me. Okay, so that's enough about confusing things. Okay, so let's wrap up with some takeaways and conclusion. First takeaway for me is the role of humor. In terms of my own view and practice, I actually think there is a place for humor in the design process, even in the context of modern software design. I guess where I see this show up most is in, usually it's going to be with copy, and it's going to be in usually earlier mockups and user flows. I think it's actually useful for a couple reasons. One, it just keeps things from getting too serious in early iterations. It's good to have that playful mindset, especially early on, and being okay with trying some things that just seem a little outlandish. Funny words and even images to some degree can help you do that. Anything from like button copy to using cartoon characters or something for stand-in users. This is kind of similar to the reason that we use lower resolution when we're working earlier. It does make it clear that there's less confidence at this point. Maybe there's still room for change and refinement, and it's expected. So it's like, well, okay, obviously we're not going to put that in the product, but it kind of helps make it more clear what you're getting at. So that clarity is the next thing that I wanted to mention here. I think it's helpful because instead of masking complexity in some short and simple, maybe typical, but like vague terms, it can really help people get aligned, because by spelling things out in an explicit and maybe humorous way, it's a way to get at, okay, what are we really saying here? What are we really trying to do? Or what do we want people to do? You can kind of explore the edges with some sort of bolder expressions and then dial back things later as needed. I guess I'll just add that I do think it is part of the delight aspect that we discussed earlier, this sort of added dimension in modern interaction design of not only utility and aesthetics, but thinking of aesthetics more broadly as delighting the end user. And so I think humor can play a role there as well, even in the final product. There is a balance there. It can be a little bit risky. Things can be misread or misinterpreted. We do want to be sensitive and inclusive, but not to the point of being sterile and kind of inhumane. Like, we don't want to offend people, but we also don't want to lose sight that there is a human being on the other end of the experience we're creating. I think we should be comfortable taking some risk that while there might be some misunderstandings, we can acknowledge each other's humanity. So the next takeaway, actually the next two, I will just preface by saying most of the stuff about the designer, I guess I'm trying to keep from the book that I am studying here. In this case, I did pull some things out of a separate book. The book is titled Paul Rand. It's by Stephen Heller. There's some really great stories in there, different perspectives, people who worked with Rand and studied with him. But so this takeaway I had that I wanted to mention here is this idea of tell the story of your solution. Rand was doing some corporate identity work. Really, that's probably some of my favorite stuff. It's the kind of stuff that really holds up over time. Things like the ABC logo, the UPS logo. You know, these are things, I mean, you can look at them today and it's just like, there's just no reason to change those things. Kind of like Vignelli talked about with American Airlines. It has meaning, it has reputation, it has history. His ad work, not as much, because that stuff is really kind of situated in a particular place and time. I mean, he did ads for like Benzedrine and cigars. That's just not going to feel as timeless. So let me read how Rand approached presenting to Next. The year is 1986. And if you didn't know, Next is the computer company that Steve Jobs started when he was kind of forced out at Apple. Rand went through this whole process, did the logo design. I'll pick up here with the story. I'll probably have to skip over some stuff because it is a little bit long. Rand had to sell the mark to Jobs and devised a two-pronged strategy. The first was to present only one logo, which underscored his own confidence in the solution and deflected indecision on the part of the client. The second was to speak only through a presentation booklet titled "The Sign of the Next Generation of Computers for Education," which concisely explained the rationale and showed the applications of the logo. At the beginning of this limited, idealistic document, Rand announced his premise. What should a logo for Next look like? He asked in text set in Caslon. This led to a concise narrative that condensed decades of communications history into 10 minutes of reading time. First, he introduced the concept of type itself. Choosing a typeface as the basis for the design of a logo is a convenient starting point. Here are two examples, Caslon and Beifer. Caslon is an alphabet designed as far back as 1725 by William Caslon. It appears to be a good choice because it is both elegant and bookish, qualities well suited for educational purposes. So then he continues, he kind of heads off this exploration that the client might want to do. So next he diffused the client's desire to sample a variety of typefaces. Quote, one reason for looking at a number of possible typefaces is to satisfy one's curiosity. Another and perhaps more meaningful one is to study the relationship of different letter combinations, to look for visual analogies and try to elicit ideas that the design of a letter or group of letters might inspire. He offered some examples. So I'm going to skip ahead. He talks about how the word next is challenging because the way it's set, it can be confused with the word exit. Some different possibilities with like lowercase and uppercase. The brief lesson in typographic style led into an explanation of how a mark should function. Ideally, a logo should explain or suggest the business it symbolizes, but this is rarely possible or even necessary. There is nothing about the IBM symbol, which Rand did, for example, that suggests computers accept what the viewer reads into it. The cube in which the computer will be housed can be such a device because it has visual impact and is easy to remember. Unlike the word next, it is depictable, possesses the promise of meaning, and the pleasure of recognition. The actual computer was a black cube, which he ended up using as inspiration. Then it says he concluded his primer with a practical analysis, blah, blah, blah. At the presentation, Rand did not utter a word. He just sat silently watching as Jobs read. The book itself was a big surprise, Jobs recalled. I was convinced that each typographic example on the first few pages was the final logo. I was not quite sure what Paul was doing until I reached the end. And at that moment, I knew we had the solution. Rand gave us a jewel, which in retrospect seems so obvious. So that was a little long, but it's a great example of how you can use this storytelling. So the takeaway I had here was tell the story of your solution. You know, nowadays, I think we've become much more accustomed to collaboration and kind of working through iteration together and presenting options and choosing options. So I'm not saying we should necessarily go back to this idea of like, you know, genius designer just comes up with one thing and then says, here it is. But I do think there is something to take away in terms of how it can be helpful to provide that context, you know, when you have spent the time to work through different ideas and solutions and maybe hit some dead ends. When you are kind of sharing where you're at now, you can tell the story when it's appropriate. I think it's interesting in these stories here how Rand used this technique to kind of create this sense of inevitability. It just exudes this confidence when you go through this story and kind of tie all this like history and considerations together. And it just all boils down to this one thing. And it just seems so obvious, as we heard Jobs say in retrospect. So I think it's something to keep in mind when we consider techniques for articulating design decisions. My last takeaway is be present at the point of execution. In this case, he's working on a book. This is much later in life. So this is around the mid-80s. He's about 70. And so decades have passed since Thoughts on Design. So he's kind of revisiting some of these essays that we've just been talking about, adding some new material for kind of a new generation of designers. And it's talking about, there's just a small passage here on the production process. It says, the new book was entirely recast, redesigned, and newly illustrated, both with Rand's vintage and more recent works. Rand also supervised the printing at Mossberg and Company in Indiana, and Charles Hillman, who headed the printing firm at that time, could not even estimate how often Rand stopped the presses to make alterations. Rand himself admitted to changing 50% of the book on press because, quote, that's part of the design process. Being in complete control of production is essential for an artist. Just to clarify, I'm talking about the book here called A Designer's Art. But yeah, I love this image of him being this active participant in the printing of the book. So he doesn't just kind of finish the manuscript and, you know, look over the changes from the editor and then wait for the book to show up. He's there on a regular basis, looking at things, tweaking things, changing things. And for him, he says, this is part of the design process. So I think this kind of idea is clearly applicable today in how we design and produce software. I mean, I'm not going to get into a whole discussion about Agile, but because software is malleable to some degree, we've seen the same kind of tension between approaches in this idea of like what we used to call big upfront design, where designers sort of put together the whole vision and hand it off to some engineers to be produced and hope it comes out well, to this much more integrated process where design is helping to create the vision and helping to define the scope, but then is right there, you know, side by side with the engineers to answer questions, kind of shepherd the vision through the implementation process, be there to ensure that things are coming out the way that they were intended. And so I think this is a very important part of the design process, as Rand talks about here. The designer needs to be present at that point of execution of the vision. So in conclusion, I really appreciate Paul Rand's approach that he takes in Thoughts on Design, respecting one's elders and understanding the past, this idea that traditional views and modern views don't have to be mutually exclusive, that the modern can build on the traditional. But I guess I hope that in my own journey on this path, I'm able to retain maybe more of a sense of coherence and relevance that I didn't personally take away from Thoughts on Design. I guess for me, I just felt some of the language was a little bit opaque. Some of the connections were not completely clear. It just wasn't as much for me to take away. I wouldn't say there's no there, but there wasn't as much there as I would have thought or hoped. On the plus side, it sent me on a deeper dive into some really interesting historical context around architecture and art theory and criticism. So I'm happy for that, and I certainly look forward to reading more of Rand's later works. Thanks for listening to Designer Sketches, my one-to-many book club where we learn together from history's most influential product designers. If you found any part of this useful, usable, or delightful, please share it with someone. You can subscribe to the podcast on Apple or Google. For related writings in addition to the episodes, check out Designer Sketches on Substack. Until next time. Back, we're back, I used to front, like Andrew, at Mechanicsburg, Anchorage, Dar es Salaam.